This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.com/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 118th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Jack Daniel. Hi, Jack.
Hello. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. Jack Daniel is a security strategist at Tenable Network Security. Jack is a leading security technology activist and a regular at ShmooCon, DEF CON, RSA, and other big security conferences. He co-hosts Security Weekly and produces the Uncommon Sense Security blog. Jack also co-founded Security B-Sides, which I'm sure you've all heard about by now. Jack started life as a car guy and has decades of experience fixing actual machines with mechanical parts. Jack now lives in Cape Cod, on Cape Cod, with his family. Sadly, his son is also a worker in the field of computer security. I'm so sorry about that last part.
Yeah, it is rough. We both work from home, and we're he's back in the house because we're eventually going to sell the house to him and move south. The last few winters we've had enough of. It is kind of funny. His office and mine are on the same floor of the house.
And he's probably severely overpaid, just like you and everything.
Yeah. And the mutterings on the phone, you can tell when we're on the typical conference call. It's when you hit mute and you hear the string of things that we all say.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I love it. So Ron Gula, who runs Tenable, has done a really interesting thing, collecting up a set of gurus, including you, to work for Tenable. And it's an interesting collection of guys. Is that strategy working?
I hope so. I like being with Tenable. I like working with Ron and with Jack and Renaud and the others. And it does give us an interesting perspective. I mean, we're not, so, you know, I work with Marcus Ranum. I work with Chris Thomas, better known to most as Space Rogue, uh-huh. And Renaud Dreyason and Paul Asadorian and Carlos Perez and a lot of other great folks. And some of them have more tightly product-defined jobs. Marcus and I do more conversations with the world of security, mm-hmm. and kind of talk about where things are headed. And we go out and we talk to customers, we talk to people who aren't customers, we talk to, you know, people in the industry.
Sure.
And try to get out ahead, so it's not the, you know, our world isn't the traditional product management view. It's further down the road, bigger picture. And,
yeah, that's cool.
It helps. And it helps us, you know, it helps Tenable know where we're going and where, you know, the industry's going, and it gives us some credibility as far as understanding people. And Marcus and I and others have the luxury of being integrated into the company well, but we're not tied to the sales team, so we can, you know, go and have very candid conversations.
Sure.
With,
yeah,
people who aren't necessarily customers, and, you know, the salespeople aren't always happy, but they respect it when you're talking to somebody and you say, oh, that's who you use.
Well and it gives you kind of sense. You know, it gives you a, you might say, a more objective view when you have people like you. You know, I've been friends with Marcus for, gosh, I think 20 years now. And to the extent that sometimes he comes over to the solstice parties and stuff like that, and he always tells the truth, whether it works or not.
it is a bit of a challenge sometimes for people. I've been on a couple of calls with Marcus and Space Rogue and myself where one of the VPs asked our opinion and didn't really want it and didn't understand.
And then found out what that means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want your candid opinion.
So it seems like it's really working for Tenable, and it's an interesting idea. I think the last time I saw it in the security space was back in the old days when SANS used to run conferences only, and they were all just a collection of gurus. There weren't any SANS people.
Right.
They weren't really doing training. They were just trying to take Usenix out, as far as I could tell. Of course, they transitioned away from that, but they had a hell of a collection of good people that would come and speak and stuff way back then.
Yeah, I think part of being able to do that requires that you have a profitable and growing company.
Gotcha.
So Tenable has the luxury.
Yep.
It's one of those critical mass things. It was certainly a gamble years ago when Ron, you know, brought Marcus in the early days, and then started bringing more folks in. It's not that we don't contribute to marketing materials or, you know, support the sales team at times or do other, you know, directly related things. But you gotta be able to put that investment out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. I'm glad to hear that it's working. I should talk to Ron about it. Really, we serve on a board together, but I haven't. We were always talking about other stuff. So that's really cool. And it makes for a fun job, huh?
Yeah, it does. As you know, you're in a similar situation, right? You start doing these things, and the next thing you know, titles like CTO aren't really just window dressing. You actually have to do the job.
I always call myself the hood ornament of the corporation, which, you know, it works for me. I wanted to ask you about communities because I know that that's important to you. If you look in your background, that word comes out a lot. So what kind of role do you believe communities play in security, especially commercial computer security?
There are a couple of things that I think are important to note when we talk about community. You have to say it plural. One of the things that becomes clear
Absolutely.
If you straddle a lot of them is that, you know, there are hundreds, if not a couple thousand of us that you'll see at DEF CON and at, you know, B-Sides Vegas or Black Hat and, you know, CANSEC, those sort of events, SHMOO. And you'll also see it in InfoSecurity or RSA, and there are a lot, though, that you don't, and they're very different personalities.
Oh, yeah.
But on the professional side, one of the things that I think that community does, or I know it does, and it varies regionally and within certain disciplines, but it solves some of the communication issues. I mean, we had certs, and we have a bunch of information sharing tools and organizations, but there's nothing like, you know, somebody that you meet at a local, whatever it is, meetup, whether it's a regional conference or whether it's your local ISACA or ISSA or ISC squared or, a whatever meetup. Somebody that you actually have pizza and beer or pizza and soft drinks with a few times a year that makes it that much easier to have a candid, maybe chat on a house rule, but a candid conversation. And so it's very powerful for that. It is powerful for information sharing when we're all very cautious. I mean, you know, almost everything we do under, you know, in our professional lives is under implied or actual NDAs.
Yep.
You know, we have to respect our intellectual property and our customers and clients and each other. And so you can't often share as widely as you'd like. The other thing that is critical, and it's shown itself especially in the B-Sides community, but in general, is the career path aspect of it.
Right. So you get a little bit of mentorship, and you can find out.
Right. You know who to ask. Right?
Yeah.
You know who to ask. It's like I'm stuck. You know, people. But there's just I won't name names, but in a group chat I'm in, I just somebody who is one of the premier pen testers got stuck. I mean, he's somebody that everybody knows, and he was
sure.
battling something. He was slugging through it. He was getting there. And somebody else popped up and said, hey, try this. And a day's worth of work went in, you know, distilled down to about an hour and pushed through. And that making those connections, and then you feel like sharing. And that's where the communities become stronger.
Yeah, you know. I think you're totally right. So you can get advice about your career. You can get advice about the field. There are people that you can kind of let your hair down with, so to speak.
Right, right. You absolutely. And, you know, that those communities, sometimes they have a couple of people that really drive them, and then those people move on or, you know, something, and they dry up. Others where you get, you know, a critical mass of people who are willing to share information. You know, that's the communities that you see where people are actually engaged more than a couple of drivers, you know, pushing it forward.
Right.
Those tend to thrive.
Yep.
And, you know, we have a, you know, we can argue whether or not the skills shortage is real or if it's just that we have such horrible technology that we need a lot of people to fix it or, you know, whatever. But In the short term, both. Right? It's like saying you shouldn't patch software, you should just write secure software.
Right,
well, that's
right.
Wonderful, but for now, we need to put some patches in.
Yeah, nobody believes you shouldn't patch it, I don't think. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, you would be better off having secure code in the first place, right? And see, that's one of those academic discussions. It's like, no, I still got to patch.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But you ever seen real code that real people write? Because it's always a mess.
Exactly. There are a lot of ways to work in community and share, and if people are willing to share, you get forward. And the jobs that are out there, so there's a career, you know, there's a shortage of people with the right skills. And one of the things the community often does, and I've seen it especially in B-Sides, because that's what I'm so heavily involved in,
sure.
But I know it happens in a lot of other communities, is that you post a job description and you've got a job description and you have to come up with something that looks like your typical HR posting.
Mm-hmm.
And you do the best you can.
And somebody needs to find out what that really means and see if they want
right.
to do it.
And
yeah, networking is great.
And then you get down to what's, you know, this person doesn't exist, who's close enough? Well, if you think of it, and it's like, well, this guy, I know somebody that's it's a NoSQL guru. He hasn't really done it in this environment, but he's got some of the skills. And, we hung out at a cocktail lounge or a tiki bar in Louisville last year.
Horrors.
You make those connections, like, hey, there we go. And that's how we get past that that first layer of HR in a lot recruiting in a lot of ways, is we find the right people or the right positions. And, you know, the converse is true. Is somebody will say, hey, I got a call from somebody wanting me to join this company, and, what's going on with them?
So, let's talk about this notion of career development. You have a really interesting past. I just listened to your podcast with Dennis Fisher on ThreatPost, which was awesome. So can you kind of summarize your story about how you moved from being a 20-year veteran mechanic, knowing about all sorts of obscure platforms, into security in, like, seven sentences?
So first of all, a lot of people ask me for career advice. I mean, the first bit of advice is don't use my career path, which was doing the wrong thing for decades.
Dude,
and then
I got a PhD in computer science, and then I was like, oh, damn, I have to be a professor? No.
I was a mechanic, as a teenager.
Yep.
And started a family early and just was working on cars. I had a knack for diagnostics, for performance diagnostics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, before computers became terribly common, I was the one that would chase down, horrible electrical
errors and fuel things. Yeah, yeah.
And just did more and more as cars became computerized, did a lot more of that. And in the process of doing those things, I transitioned into working in the parts and service departments where, the folks behind the parts counter at your average car dealership are usually the people that run the computer systems,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
they, at least traditionally, had more interaction with systems for parts ordering and other things.
And it's a quote-unquote back office job,
Right.
You get a desk and everything.
Yeah, so I moved into parts and service management, but because of my diagnostic skills, I worked on cars part-time even when I was managing a technology for dealer groups across the Boston area. I would occasionally get called in. It's like, we have this automatic transmission we can't fix. I'm like, okay, I'll see you at 11 o'clock tonight and fix it.
So,
the diagnostics was part of it. But basically, I went from fixing cars to working on the infrastructure of the dealer organizations, which meant using computers. And more and more computer use until one day all I was doing was computers, or almost all I was doing computers. And then bad things happened, and I had to fix them.
Yeah.
And then bad things happened again, and then I had to fix them and keep them from happening again, which summarizes how a lot of us get into security.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, that was dumb of me, and that opened the door for a bad person.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you understand highly complex systems, and that was the first thing that you did. And frankly, I mean, my first car back in 1976 was a Subaru, and they made one model, and I could figure out how it was supposed to work. You just open it up, and I could tell then. But those years ended about 1979, when cars began being computers and the modern car design thing happened,
right.
Now it's impossible to repair a car without a computer. And yeah. and we even have DMCA problems with, you know, tractors, for God's sakes. So
right.
Do you think that security design and security engineering are in some sense experiencing the same thing that the car guys experienced 20 years ago?
I think there are, I like to make bad analogies. So let's, the comparisons do fall apart. But if you think about what we're doing, what we've been doing in going from mainframes to client server to virtualization to cloud and now, you know, the distributed cloud systems, mm-hmm. containerization, mm-hmm. where we're really getting away from, even as an admin, you're getting away from carrying, you know, some expensive box, expensive yellow machine that says Fluke on it to diagnose problems. Mm-hmm. You know, those days are largely gone.
Right.
But if you can't think back to it, if you can't think about, you know, when the points open, the condenser discharges voltage, and then that sends a spike up to the, you know, the distributor cap, you know, triggers the coil. Anyway, you know, if you can't think to back to the fundamentals.
Yeah. It's harder to know what's going on.
And we
right?
are. And right. So you look at, like you said, you look under your hood of your old Subaru or, you know, my old 76 Gremlin or something like that. And
yeah.
I can figure this out.
Yeah. You can say, you oh, I see how a combustion engine works, but not anymore.
Yeah. And, when there was that box that ran NetWare, or, you know, NT or whatever in the corner, and then the clients talked to that, and there were a couple of switches and then that router thing and a firewall thing.
That was pretty simple.
You could see how it worked,
yeah.
right? And now
yeah.
it's like, wait, when I'm working on a presentation, am I on my laptop or am I in the cloud or somewhere in between? Am I caching? Where's that data? How does this work? I think there is a parallel there. And
yeah, it's really interesting. And I also think that, you know, vast experience, even in a different domain with complex systems, is a hugely powerful thing that in some sense might be being professionalized right on out of our industry. In fact, you know, Dan Geer and I have both written about the neo-renaissance going on in security years ago. We've been talking about that, where creative people from lots of different backgrounds come together, and it's really interesting and an interesting time in a new field. But professionalization, which has been happening in about 10 years now, brings things in a different direction. And in some sense,
absolutely.
You may not be able to bring in some crazy knowledge about something that nobody else knows. What do you think about that? How does
I completely agree. I've had these thoughts and conversations too. Where do you, you know, in a time when everybody came from something else?
Yeah.
You know, you get this diversity. The flip side is, you know, we have some maturity of the industry. We have people that go that in, you know, high school decide this is what they want to do. They go to college, or in college they flip and decide they want to be in our field and mm-hmm. get a degree in it and come out and go to work. And that brings, you know, can bring a level of stability and professionalism and maturity.
Yep.
But it also, as you said, we don't have that diverse view of the world.
Yeah, it's really,
and I think we still do, but we're in you know, in danger of losing that.
Well, in some sense, you need people at all levels of the discipline too. Like if you think about medicine, it's not like everybody's a brain surgeon. You know,
right.
In fact, most people are EMTs, and followed by nurses, followed by doctors, followed by surgeons. And they have different backgrounds in some sense. So maybe we'll find some stasis or some point that makes sense when we get to that stage where we have different levels of professionalization requiring different backgrounds.
Yeah, let's hope so. But I see both the advantages or the potential advantages and certainly the potential and real disadvantages.
Yeah, me too.
Not being able to function in bizarre, you know, how well you handle things going horribly wrong.
Yeah, and also unexpected, you know, crazy things. And, you know, the idea of drawing analogies, which I love to do too. I actually studied analogy in grad school, believe it or not. That helps you think through new problem situations in ways that would never occur to you if you didn't have anything to map the analogy to. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about B-Sides. What is B-Sides? Why did you start it?
The short version of this is that in June, I guess it was, June of 2009, the annual rejection letters from Black Hat and DEF CON started flying out. And
yeah.
That was the first year that there was a real mass of security people and, you know, the hacker community had started to really come together on Twitter as a communication platform.
Right.
And so there was a lot of venting on Twitter, and, you know, a bunch of us had conversations, people, and a few of us had, you know, got on the phone or Skype or whatever and chatted. Yeah, some of these talks looks like a good talk, but they're probably, you know, I don't know what it was, mobile malware or something, whatever the big deal was.
Right.
Like, you know, Black Hat and DEF CON can only do so many of these talks.
Yes.
It's like, oh, that one is the same talk he's been doing for 3 years. I see why they turned it down. And
then
there were other talks that were like, oh, that's just a little bit niche. That's not something that Black Hat is likely to take on. And, you know, in fairness, Black Hat's added a lot more tracks, and they get a lot
more. It's become more like your RSA every year. It's kind of like big-ass trade show.
We said, you know, some of these, what if we, Chris Nickerson and the DC 303, the Denver DC crew, used to rent a house every year instead of, you know, getting a bunch of hotel rooms. How about if we just have some folks come out and do talks at the house? And it was no big plan to change the world or anything. It's like, let's get together. And it was basically a... it was not a mansion or anything, but it was a decent-sized house with a big room that they used for a wedding chapel. And we did a 2 days' worth of talks.
And it turned out to be fun.
You know, some of the talks were things that didn't fit. Val Smith did an absolutely nuts Val Smith sort of psycho hacker political rant that was beautiful but was not going to go on stage.
Right.
Aaron Jacobs and several others did a panel discussion on issues, on gender issues in information security,
uh-huh.
You know, 5 years before RSA put it on stage.
This
was a huge one, and it had, you know, we had a bunch of people that everybody knows on there, from Jen Jabish, now Manila, a whole bunch of people with a bunch of different perspectives on that. And that was another topic that, you know, wasn't going to happen there.
So it's a good, an idea of bringing in those wider ideas on purpose and putting them in.
And the name B-Sides was, you know, from the days of vinyl, when the A-side was what got played on AM,
yep.
And the B-side was where you let the bass player prove he was really a musician or whatever it was.
As a musician, you know, that makes me really happy.
Yeah. You know, and so that was the thing. It's the B-side. And the first one was run opposite Black Hat in July of 2009.
Yep.
And we realized that model of outboarding and just being parasitic, you know, maybe that's harsh, but that was the way some saw it. The other conferences wasn't it. The second event was actually not even parallel with anything else. And
there
was one that ran alongside RSA.
Right.
We had never really planned on this becoming a thing. It was just, we'll try this once and see what happens.
Well, listen,
and
man, I remember when ShmooCon was just an idea that Bruce had with Heidi. And I mean, look at it now. And the same thing with Black Hat. I mean, these things kind of evolve in that direction accidentally. So the real question is, will B-sides end up being like Black Hat, and then you're going to have a C-sides or a FM radio thing? I don't know.
Some of the folks will might be frustrated with me for saying, but B-Sides Las Vegas certainly has this challenge right now. We are 2,400 people.
That's
big. Probably going to be about 2,500 people this year, which is capacity for the venue.
Right.
You can't have the feeling. Last year, B-Sides Las Vegas, between the safety and security team, the regular volunteers, and the core organization team, the 22 or 23 team leaders plus their seconds, we were somewhere around 220 people working on the event, which is larger than total attendance of the first year.
So what's really funny is it's kind of like, you know, you start out as the counterculture, and then you become a movement like the hippies were, and then all of a sudden you get into power it's sort of hard to criticize because right. you are the establishment. I mean, it was you can see that unfold in the political arena as well.
Well, you know, with the B-Sides model, it's extremely decentralized. You know, there are a handful of us on the global board, which mm-hmm. is the American 501c3, and we do sort of brand protection, brand management, if you will, mm-hmm. but our primary function is coordinating and supporting the organizers who run their own events.
Right,
and,
right, right. So it's a collective kind of...
Yeah, as of last weekend, there have been 233 events around the globe.
That is amazing. Well, congratulations on that. That's cool, Jack.
Yeah, the last one was in Lagos, Nigeria. So another new city, a new country. Dozens of countries and, almost 100 different
cities. That's amazing. Let's talk about tribes, all right? So security has a whole set of tribes. We sort of talked about them a little bit in the community. I started out in the science academic tribe. With people like Avi Rubin and Ed Felton, for example, a bunch of computer scientists. But I'm also part of the commercial security tribe, which is a worrisome tribe indeed. And then there's the Hacker Boy researcher tribe, which sort of you hang out with. And, you know, this tribe that sometimes the tribes interact, sometimes there are people that interact between tribes. We all like each other and respect each other, but they're tribes. So... were there tribes like that in mechanics, in car mechanics?
We didn't get together that often. The only time we saw each other as, you know, for example, mechanics or in automotive management was at trainings or events put on by the manufacturers, which were there to push their
latest. Exactly. So they were just marketing junkets, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there was some... in the mechanical training stuff, there was a little bit of getting together. And, you know, you would go to a class and you would learn something. And depending on the instructor, you might actually make connections with the instructor.
Right. That makes sense. But it seems like there might have been, say, Renault mechanic. Like, there's only six guys who know that.
Yeah, there weren't many. You know, I didn't know any other Renault mechanics when I was doing Renaults in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. I didn't know any others except for the factory people that I interacted with who were AMC folks because they were rare. I mean, I knew a couple of people.
Well, so let's talk about the tribes that do exist in security. What is your feeling about the tribes and their mixing or their trifurcation or whatever? You know, how do you think it should go, does go? How do you feel about the whole thing?
One of the things that comes up a lot, so right now we're in the run-up to RSA, and so the those who self-describe as hacker first, have their annual RSA is irrelevant, it's a failure, it's miserable rant going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are things about RSA that frustrate us.
Of course. That's the most worrisome tribe, for sure.
But I have a really hard time saying something that has, 400 and some odd talks, and, you know, they're not all cutting edge, but there are a lot of good talks if that's what you're interested in. Are they Black Hat? Are they, you know, CanSec West? Are they ShmooCon kind of talks?
No, but they're talks. No. And the thing is, everybody's coming to town, like everybody who does business in securities in town.
Right. If you've got, so last year there were over 33,000 people there. I'm not sure how you call 500 plus exhibitors, 30,000 plus participants a failure.
Right.
is it too commercial? Yeah, you know, it's highly commercial. Yeah. But of course, the vast majority of those of us that are part of, you know, that hacker tribe make our living in there. So it's kind of, some folks really get wound up and start biting the hand that feeds them. It's kind of like the pen test tribe is one of the more adamant, and, you know, they like to make fun of PCI, but if the PCI requirements removed the pen test requirement, how many pen testers would be unemployed?
irony.
That group. Any one of these tribes has that same myopia. This just happens to be one that's been like front and center on a couple of things for me lately. You know,
here's a question. I mean, does B-Sides have a tribe, or is it just people who
B-Sides
didn't have a tribe?
Multiple tribes.
Yeah.
In regional areas, B-Sides has helped build some tribes. In places that didn't have much community, that hadn't, you know, hadn't had that OWASP chapter that became a catalyst or whatever it was.
Yeah, you know, BSIM community did the very same thing. So we have these people talking to each other in an amazing way. And when you find your long-lost brother, it's like, whoa.
Right. Yeah, and there are certainly, B-sides tend to be much more inclusive. Now, every now and then something happens and somebody gets excluded for something or another, and it's, you can't put thousands of people together without having some...
Exactly. All it takes is more than three.
Yeah, that's one of the key things that I do in the community. And, a lot of times I just want to grab people by the
shoulder. You engender controversy?
Yeah. I want to grab their heads, smash them together until they play nice. What I do is have to be, conciliatory.
Oh, I thought you were saying the opposite.
No, I want to sometimes just, club them like baby heart seals. But I, give them a hug and say, look, we don't all have to agree on
it. Get it together. Yeah,
On the tribe idea, B-Sides Vegas, I think, is an interesting thing because of the way it's grown. One of the ways we try to keep the feeling of B-Sides in something that is that size is that there are actually sub-tribes. You could think of it as a nation, and then there are tribes within it. The data science track is a semi-autonomous.
Yeah. You see that in big corporations. Like if you ever worked with Microsoft or at Microsoft, there's the federal government and then there's the state government, which is like office. Absolutely. And then there's like the Expedia people that are like South America. I mean, they're all little branches that sometimes don't even talk.
Yeah, the tribe that we really put a lot of effort into supporting is the what we call the proving ground, and that's the folks that work to get new speakers, people that haven't spoken on national stage, partnered with mentors, to get them, give their first talk in a supportive environment, give them constructive criticism and feedback, and help them go, and draw more people in that are able to share what they know in a coherent way.
And that makes all tribes stronger. That's very cool work. I got one more question for you, which is more down my neck of the woods. So as a software security guy and a security engineer, I worry about what a massive overemphasis in our field on hacking and breaking things is doing. Like, especially at cons, but even at some trade shows, like Black Hat. Shouldn't Black Hat have a builder's track by now? Like, what the heck?
I have some sympathy for Black Hat because I know folks that are on the review board. They don't get, they have an image and it's like the commercialism of RSA and the commercials. Right. You start heading down a path and gravity kind of takes over.
I don't know. Showstack tried to turn that and he didn't do, it didn't happen.
Yeah, it didn't, people go to Black Hat to break stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
In some conferences, smaller ones do, ShmooCon has really made an effort to push more emphasis in the past several years onto that repair track. But it's fun, breaking stuff.
But this isn't just repair, Jack. It's I'm talking about security engineering from the beginning.
That is one of the things that me being a college dropout and having stumbled into this, one of the things that I wish I had is that academic background to understand how we got where we are from the sitting in a classroom with a professor. Have some fundamental challenges, and I think that at a very tactical level, people that are fighting the fight are continuously just fighting battles, right? And it's a ton of wasted effort. Anybody that's working on securing, 10 years ago, anybody that was working on securing Symbian, all of their effort's gone. People that, that spent a lot of effort securing NT, granted, they had a long way to go even when we gave up on NT.
What we can say is, thank goodness most of their effort is gone.
Right. But those things are gone. The people that built QNX, there were one or two things still running it. So there's when we're doing this, there's this absolute thing where we put a ton of effort into highly volatile solutions. They're gone in years.
Yeah, that's very well thought out. I think that's right. Highly volatile is the exact right way to describe that. So it's hard to get up over and get out of the moment and do some meta-level analysis.
I think that one of the things I've been doing is my Shoulders of InfoSec project and looking at some of the historical figures because it's ignorance on my part, and so I try to share what I know.
Matt Bishop?
I do not.
Oh, my goodness. I got a guy for you to know and everybody else listening. Matt Bishop is a professor at UC Davis, And he did a history project, which still has collected thousands of excellent resources in academic computer security and other places too, which is well worth understanding, goes back into the 70s and really early classified stuff. And Matt is really open to talking to everybody, and he would love to chat with you about that.
That's awesome. The Babbage Institute, University of Minnesota, has a lot of the histories too.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found looking at these folks is that if we look at early computer systems, they were horribly insecure. You know, we go back to mainframe sort of things, early government and military systems.
Well, they were secure in the sense that you just closed the door. Nobody could get
in
there.
Right, but, they were securable in that if you followed the copper wire, you found everybody that was connected to it.
Right.
And then they started making progress, but somewhere, there's a series of things that happened in my feeble mind that I think kind of set us up for, I won't say set us up for failure because it's changed the world largely for the better, but we got global interconnectivity.
Yeah. What we got before that?
Consumerization.
Guess what we got before that? Software.
Software, right. But we got consumerization and global interconnectivity, which led to commoditization, and now it's cheaper to run a processor with a full OS on it to, Internet of Things or whatever you want to pick on.
Yeah, stuff that, run your dishwasher.
Why are you running a full OS on that? It needs to do these
things. One way to describe this is it used to be that the people were cheap and the computers were expensive, relatively speaking. Now the computers are cheap and the people are expensive.
That's an interesting perspective, and that's true. Yeah.
I got to wrap it up, but wow, fascinating. It's been great to get to know you a little bit. So I've been into craft cocktails for a decade, and I know you are too. I have a really fancy bar at home, and you, by the way, are invited. Not everybody listening, but you, Jack, are invited. So what's your favorite kind of boozy beverage and or cocktail, and bonus points for a recipe you invented yourself?
The recipes I invent myself tend to be what's available at the bar and see if I can make it taste good.
Yeah.
But my drink preferences go in two fairly different directions. I am a big fan of bourbons and ryes. And so classic things, when I go to a bar that I want to see if they can deliver, want a Sazerac or a Boucheret or something like that. The other one is I am an aficionado of good tiki drinks, the kind of stuff that Don Beach made.
Guess where I was yesterday, or I guess it was Sunday night, Three Dots and a Dash in Chicago. Fantastic.
So that's the other one. So that's one of Paul McGee's. He's now not part of that. He's moved on, and he's got another one the other side of town in Chicago called Lost Lake. And those two are phenomenal. Yep. His new one, Lost Lake, was just voted, just named best cocktail bar in America. And it's a sort of divey tiki bar.
I know. I know. I would have gone there except for Three Dots and a Dash was a block away.
Three Dots and a Dash is right there near where you always are. And it's fantastic. Right. Yeah. And the crew that's there, I've had great conversations with people. And so those kind of, not the slushy, crappy things.
Oh,
but those I tend not to make because they have a lot of ingredients. They're hard. But, I will go with, I have a progression. If I'm out and don't want to see how a bartender responds, I'll start, see if you can do an old fashioned or Manhattan. And when they pull the bottle of Gallo vermouth out, I'll just take that rye neat.
Never mind. Stop now.
Stop. Right. And then, the Sazerac kind of takes another step. And if you ask for a Boucheret or something, then they're, they kind of give you a look. And if the look is, this could be fun. And then you usually can say, hey, or go in whatever direction you want. And then sometimes you find the folks that are really into the history and you start getting earlier brandy cocktails and things, which are fun to play with.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2015 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is devoted to the economics of cybersecurity. The issue features our interview with the European cryptographer Bart Pernille. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.